It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Tim Hagel in our Iowa City studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And Scott Peters joins us in our Cedar Falls studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Scott Peters, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
A little bit later in the program, we definitely want to focus a good deal of the program on the Gorsuch confirmation hearings now in its third day, but also that Obamacare repeal and replace vote coming down to the wire in the U.S. House, and also the hearings we heard on Monday about Russian involvement in our 2016 elections. You can join our conversation as we go through these points, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Of course, we're all watching developments with the attack at the United Kingdom Parliament building, an attacker being shot, and we will bring you those updated news developments as they become available. And Tim Hagel, whenever we have one of these attacks, of course, it has political implications.
Oh, absolutely. And especially for a new administration, a Trump administration, which maybe doesn't quite have its foot on the ground, it may have to deal with this. Even though it's in another country, it certainly puts a number of American cities, New York, Washington, D.C., and so forth, on heightened alert. But we'll have to wait and see what's happening, although apparently London is treating this as a terrorist event. We don't seem to have, or I haven't seen any details of the specifics as far as the person that was the attacker.
Mm-hmm. Right. Here and now, coming up after this program at 1 o'clock, also the BBC will certainly have great coverage of it at 3 o'clock here on Iowa Public Radio, and, of course, All Things Considered. So stay with us this afternoon to keep abreast of that. Right now, let's dig into some political analysis of Judge Neil Gorsuch in the midst of the third day of his confirmation hearings for a seat, that vacant ninth seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. It's going on right now all day. Let's hear a couple of the excerpts from yesterday's hearings. Two exchanges during yesterday's Senate Judiciary Committee hearing between Senator Lindsey Graham, in this case, and Neil Gorsuch, aimed at determining the nominee's independence from President Trump and the promises he made on the campaign trail with regards to abortion and torture.
In that interview, did he ever ask you to overrule Roe v. Wade?
No, Senator.
What would he have done if he'd asked?
Senator, I would have walked out the door.
Okay, another exchange between the two?
If you start waterboarding people, you may get impeached. Is that a fair summary?
Senator, the impeachment power belongs to this body.
Okay, that's even better. Would he be subject to prosecution?
Senator, I'm not going to speculate.
But he's not above the law.
No man is above the law.
Okay.
No man.
Okay, join us as we go through the confirmation hearings so far for the Supreme Court seats. What do you think of the hearing process? Do we learn much? Have you been watching? What questions do you have? 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Scott Peters, let me turn to you first of all. I know this is in your wheelhouse here as we look at the judiciary. What have we found out so far during these hearings?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure we've found out all that much in the sense that I'm not sure that we know that much more or know any more about Judge Gorsuch than we knew before. I mean, we knew his general approach to interpreting the law. We knew that approach would be very likely to have more politically conservative outcomes. We knew that Democrats weren't happy about this process, mm-hmm. that Democrats would rather have Merrick Garland on the bench. We knew that Republicans are clearly going to support the president's nominee. So a lot of what we see here is over the last 30 years or so, nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court have gotten very good and very well practiced at really not telling us much when they are questioned at these hearings.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, so do you agree with Scott there that this, I guess, not to put words in his mouth, mostly for show, for We're not really finding out too much, and we didn't expect to find out too much.
No, that's exactly right. And as I spend a lot of time in my judicial process course talking about nominations to the Supreme Court, and really we saw a major change in how this worked with the Bork nomination back in the late 80s, so it has been about 30 years. And that's when they were televised and people started really paying attention to it. And what we found is in fact, what Scott was saying, is that it's mainly for show, and that the judges, and as much as we may like to have them answer more direct questions, they really aren't supposed to. And this is one of the things that Gorsuch has emphasized is by judicial ethics, he's not supposed to talk about how he would rule on particular cases. And a lot of the Republicans in particular pointing out that Ginsburg, when she was a nominee, didn't really start with her, but it was emphasized a lot where she basically said, look, I can't talk about that because the case along those lines might come before me. So this is nothing new. But it's not entirely for show in that it does have meaning in the sense that to the extent that one side or the other, depending on which party nominated the person, that they're trying to poke holes in the person's judicial philosophy or point out cases that may be an embarrassment or something of those lines, and that can play to the senator's base.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the name Bork there in passing just a few minutes ago, and that really was a milestone or a turning point, I guess you could say, in confirmation hearings. Am I correct in saying that goes back to the Reagan administration?
Reagan administration,
and
right.
And there is a reason. We have not had a Supreme Court justice named Bork. What happened?
Well, basically, there are a couple of problems with Robert Bork. The first was that he had a lot of political baggage going back to the Watergate era in the mid-70s. He also came across as a very cold person, kind of an academic, had a lot of writings behind him, too. And so it gave the senators, Democratic senators, a lot of ammunition. And in fact, on the day that his nomination was announced, then-Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts gave what's the famous Bork's America speech, where he really tore down Bork and said all these terrible things would happen if Bork was the nominee. And Bork could never recover from that. And there were a number of problems along those lines that Bork didn't want to play to the television cameras, wanted to answer questions he probably shouldn't have been answering. And as I tell my students, he had a really horrendous comb over that just did not look good on television.
Scott Peters, to you, is this where we get beginning of the huge divide on this matter in the 1980s with Robert Bork?
To some extent, yes. I mean, it certainly kind of reaches an apex. I would say it goes back a little farther than that. Nixon, for example, campaigned quite openly in 1968 against liberal judges and against the Warren Court, and made a very concerted effort to choose his nominees more ideologically. If we go back to the middle part of the 20th century and often before that, presidents would sometimes be kind of ideological in the way they chose their Supreme Court justices, but sometimes even as high as the Supreme Court, those positions would be given out more on kind of a patronage terms, you know, to repay political favors and things like that. By the early 1970s, presidents are trying to pay more attention to judicial nominations. They get more ideological. And then particularly with the Reagan administration, there's much more focus on ideology. There's a fair amount of evidence that over time, by the time we get to Clinton and the second President Bush and President Obama, that presidents are actually getting much better at this, in the sense that from the president's point of view, they're getting better. They are more accurately putting people on the bench who are likely to hold their view of the law and their view of public policy. And as presidents have gotten more ideological, senators have also gotten more ideological. And all of this, of course, takes place in the context of increasingly ideological and polarized political parties.
How would you, when you put Neil Gorsuch next to Antonin Scalia, how do they compare in terms of their approach to judging cases?
From everything I can see, pretty comparable.
Which means what?
Yeah. So they ascribe to a view of the Constitution in particular that says that they should try to discern the original meaning of the Constitution when they're faced with those cases. I'm sure that there would be individual cases on which Judge Gorsuch's views might differ from what Justice Scalia's were, but In the long run, I think the overall patterns would end up pretty similar. Estimates of his ideology based on his voting record as an appellate court judge actually place him to the right of Scalia. I saw one estimate that places him just to the left of Clarence Thomas, and I saw another estimate that actually places him as more conservative than Clarence Thomas. So, you know, the general judicial philosophies are similar, and the implications of that in terms of public policy are quite similar.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the testimony we've heard the last two and a half days. It's currently ongoing in Washington. Tim, do you think Neil Gorsuch, is successful so far in persuading senators he's his own man?
Actually, there are two parts to that. There's the question of whether he's going to be successful or is successful and whether he's persuading anybody. And I think that the answer to the first is that he's been successful in accomplishing what he needs to accomplish in a hearing such as this, which is that he's managed to stick to his idea that I'm a judge, I'm not supposed to comment on current cases, I'm not supposed to give my opinion, I'm just supposed to read the law. And that's where the idea of looking at, although Gorsuch says he doesn't like labels and there's often some confusion about what something like originalism, original intent means, basically he says, look, as a judge, I need to first look at the text and the plain meaning. The question of persuasion is different because, again, as we were saying, probably the Republicans in the Senate are going to vote for him, and most of the Democrats are not. And the question really is what's going to happen in terms of the cloture vote. Are they going to get eight Democrats to say, yes, let's have a vote on this fellow? And if they do have a vote, how many of the Democrats might actually approve him?
Mm. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tim Hagel with us of the University of Iowa, Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa. It's Politics Wednesday, of course, looking at the Gorsuch hearings right now. Of course, throughout these hearings, Merrick Garland, a shadow cast over these, especially for the Democrats. I wonder, Scott, how much has this denial of Obama's appointee, Judge Merrick Garland, didn't even get a hearing, let alone a vote. How much has that colored this proceeding and likely to color the votes of the Democrats?
Oh, it's entirely colored it. I mean, it's the Democrats view this as an unprecedented denial of a basic constitutional power of a president to fill a judicial vacancy. And, you know, that's the principle. And the policy implications are even greater because it was the Democrats' first chance in decades to change the composition of the Supreme Court to replace a conservative justice with a more liberal one. And that's a missed opportunity from the Democrats' standpoint that who knows when it could happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Let's listen to our Senator Charles Grassley in an interview on NPR's Morning Edition yesterday. Charles Grassley, he is key here, of course, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was asked what he would say to convince Democratic colleagues to vote to confirm Judge Gorsuch, given their disappointment in hearings not being held for President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. Senator Dick Blumenthal called that lack of hearings a constitutional dereliction and obstruction. Here's how Senator Grassley responded.
Well, one thing, it would be testimony yesterday by Neil Katyal. He was Solicitor General under Obama, who has come out in favor of him as one thing. I think Senator Bennett, a Democrat, had good things to say about him yesterday. But I would go back to the words of obstruction and that Senator Blumenthal said and say that was it not obstruction when Biden said 30 years ago at the end of H.W. Bush's presidency, if there's a vacancy, it ought to go over to the new president. Not only that, but a long time before the election, when we assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States, I was asked, am I going to hold it up for another 4 years if she's president of the United States? I said, no.
Hmm. Okay, Senator Grassley there. Scott Peters, what do you make of the points that Grassley makes, especially the one about Joe Biden being really the one who obstructed?
Well, that's a red herring because that was a hypothetical comment that Joe Biden made.
Nothing
about,
was
about
ever done.
About was, a vacancy that yeah. didn't exist and never existed. So Joe Biden did, as Joe Biden always has, you know, he spoke from the hip and spoke loosely and was talking about what would happen if a vacancy were to occur, and he hypothesized this, but no such vacancy occurred, no such obstruction ever took place. So to cite that as some sort of precedent, I think, is somewhat disingenuous. You know, the fact is that the only previous example of this happening was in 1968 when Republicans filibustered President Johnson's nominated replacement for Chief Justice Warren. And, you know, I would argue that if we argue about justification, Republicans were probably more justified in 1968 than they were last year, in the sense that in 1968, Chief Justice Warren was resigning for what you could argue were more political reasons, you know, to try to sort of keep the chief justiceship in Democratic hands for the long haul, so to speak. Whereas last year, I mean, Justice Scalia died. That wasn't anything that anybody was planning on or was trying to engineer. But before 1968, you have to go all the way back to 1932 to even see an election year vacancy. So the truth about all this is not really that there was any sort of principle about not filling vacancies during the election years. The truth was there were just very rarely any vacancies during election years.
I have to disagree with part of that, especially a part of the idea that it's a red herring, because what you saw with the Biden rule, as it's come to be known, or at least as Republicans wanted to call it, was actually part of what could have been a plan on the part of Senate Democrats that during the Bush administration, that they had been George W. Bush administration, that they had been basically preempting or filibustering a number of Bush's nominees to the Court of Appeals. And the idea was to perhaps signal to the members of the Supreme Court that they shouldn't, in fact, retire at a time when Bush was maybe have the opportunity to appoint someone to the Supreme Court. And it seemed to work that based on at least my model that I have of political retirements for the Supreme Court, that you would think that certain times you would expect certain justices who may be ideologically similar to the current president would retire, like in their first term or first year of their term or third year of their term. And that didn't happen. And I think one of the reasons was because Democrats in the Senate, who controlled the Senate in 2006, or actually after the 2006 election, were basically saying, look, we're just not going to approve anybody. And so even though it didn't happen, that Biden was out there on record and others, Democrats are basically engaged in a strategy which seemed to want to prevent any retirements from occurring. So we don't know, of course, because none did occur. So it didn't happen in that sense. But at least there were statements and actions out there that would seem to support what the Republicans were arguing.
Given what we know now about Neil Gorsuch, Scott Peters, does it make sense strategically for the Democrats to filibuster and risk the Republicans, I guess, making a rule change to get this judge seated as a justice?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that's a very big debate within the Democratic caucus in the Senate. I guess personally, I would lean toward making the Republicans do that at a time that it counts more, has more consequences, a prospective nomination that would actually change the balance on the court, for example. But ultimately, you know, Democrats have their base to satisfy, and the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party is sort of demanding action, that the Democrats do everything they can to try to stop this.
Even if everything they can will definitely, or it looks at to be falling short at this point.
Right. And so they, you know, politically they might have to shore up that wing of their party. I'm not sure. The last thing I read seemed to indicate that leadership was leaning toward not doing that, not holding it up and allowing it to proceed to a vote under normal order.
What about this? I guess it's Chuck Schumer who was saying this, that these hearings, this whole process should be held up because of the investigations we'll talk about in the next half hour into the Russian involvement in our elections. Scott Peters, was that just for public consumption or could that gain traction?
That seems unlikely to gain traction to me. I mean, occasionally you will see things like that in the Senate where people hold up one moving forward on a nomination because of something else that is not moving forward. I don't know. I think that's a pretty tenuous connection to make in this case.
Mm-hmm. So that was Tim, for public consumption for a news cut or something like that? Why did Chuck Schumer do that?
A shot in the dark, I suppose. Maybe it'll work. Again, it keeps the Russian stuff in the news a little bit more, although it's in the news a lot anyway.
Right. It doesn't really need any help.
It would seem there's little connection. And if there were some connection with Gorsuch and some Russian thing or other sorts of things going on, then maybe it would make sense. But Gorsuch has gotten high marks from all across the judicial spectrum. Whether you agree with his politics or not, or his general results, it seems to have no connection with what else is going on with the Trump administration.
Before we go to break, let me ask you, Scott Peters, as an observer of this, did you any other notable exchanges? I'll ask each of you before we go to break that you've seen in the testimony so far.
I guess one of the ones that's getting a lot of attention was Al Franken and that case with the frigid truck driver who left his cargo by the roadside because he was stuck in a snowstorm or something. You know, this gets to a lot of differences you see sometimes between Democrats and Republicans, where Republicans and conservative-leaning judges tend to favor what is sometimes called a more formalistic view of the law, and Democrats try to encourage a view of the law that the word they sometimes use is a word of a view of the law that encourages more empathy for the people involved in the lawsuits. So, you know, that might be one that mm-hmm. people might want to look into.
Yeah, and I would have actually said the same one, and it was an interesting exchange, and it's come up a couple of times. Feinstein talked about it today as well, and the idea of who is it that you're for? And the response from Gorsuch, and again, it's the more, I suppose, if you want to frame it that way, the formalistic approach is Gorsuch says, look, as a judge, I'm supposed to look at the law, and if Congress or state legislature doesn't pass a good law, that's not the judge's fault or job to necessarily fix it, but to interpret it as is. And that's sort of a different judicial philosophy than, as was indicated, that Democrats usually prefer.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before we go to break, I guess the major judicial questions likely to come before a Supreme Court with a Judge Gorsuch, should he be confirmed, would be the constitutionality of the Trump travel ban, wouldn't it, Scott Peters? That would be one likely headed there?
Certainly could be headed there, and the administration would be much more likely to want it to be there with Gorsuch on the bench than with a 4-4 tie. There's also a major religious liberty case that I think the administration would like him on the bench for yet this year, but I'm not sure that that'll happen.
Okay. We'll be back with Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, our political analysts, during this Politics Wednesday. We'd like you to join our conversation. We'll talk when we come back about the health care repeal vote coming down to the wire in the U.S. House, the implications of it going either way, that when we come back, and also the investigation into Russian meddling in our U.S. elections in 2016. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, neuroscientists used to believe that only drugs could stimulate addiction. New research shows that addictive behaviors produce the same brain responses. Tomorrow on this program, New York Times bestselling author Adam Alter about his new book. It's titled Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. That's tomorrow on the program. Today, Politics Wednesday edition with Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Scott Peters of the University of Northern Iowa. Plenty of politics to talk about. You can join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. Let's move on to Monday's hearings before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, where FBI Director James Comey confirmed that his agency is investigating possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. He also pushed back against President Trump's allegations that he was wiretapped by former President Obama. The Committee on Intelligence also heard National Security Agency Director Mike Rogers about Russia's general attempts to influence the U.S. presidential election, and the controversial possibly illegal leak of classified information to the press. Let's listen to Director Comey on Monday.
I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. As with any counterintelligence investigation, this will also include an assessment of whether any crimes were committed.
Okay. Director Comey there on Monday. Tim Hagel, what are the implications of what we heard on Monday to make it official that there is an investigation? It's been taking place since July of 2016, as a matter of fact, on these questions that he just named.
You know, it's hard to say. It's official confirmation. Most people suspected that that was occurring at one level or another. But again, to have the director and the admiral that was there as well talk about this and from an intelligence point of view and that the investigation is ongoing certainly makes it important, and it certainly gives Democrats additional political fodder to talk about, and they did a lot during the hearing. In fact, one of the things I guess changed the subject a little bit is what's interesting about the hearing to me is that there were actually three hearings going on at the same time, or three main topics, and you kind of mentioned them in your intro in the sense they were talking about the question of the accuracy of Trump's tweets about wiretapping. The Republicans tended to focus on the illegality of revealing Mike Flynn's name. And then the Democrats tended to focus on any possible connections, along with their wiretap tweet, the possible connections with the Trump campaign with Russian officials. And so it was interesting to see the question because they jumped back and forth among those three topics pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm. Scott Peters, what do you think of Monday's hearings?
Oh, I would agree with Tim that mostly what they did, at least for those who have been paying close attention to the various news stories, mostly what they did was provide official confirmation for what we already knew. And then, of course, if you watch the hearings or read the coverage of it, you have both sides attempting to focus on the aspects of it that are most embarrassing to the other side. So Republicans trying to focus on the possibility that leaks are being used politically by Democrats. You even had some Republicans throwing out what I assume were hypothetical names of high-profile former Obama administration officials, wondering whether those people were the leakers, and if they were, would they be investigated, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting out in today's news, Donald Trump's ex-campaign chair, Paul Manafort, facing fresh allegations. A new report out today alleging that Paul Manafort worked for a Russian billionaire more than a decade ago in order to advance the agenda of Russia's President Putin. This is a report by the Associated Press, appearing to undermine the assertions by the Trump administration and by Paul Manafort as well that he never worked to promote Russia's global influence. Would that be, I mean, if you have him on record saying he never worked to promote Russia's global influence, and now we have a report proving that he got millions of dollars to do just that, that would be pretty damning, wouldn't it, Tim Hagel?
It would, and it's very curious in the sense that, again, assuming that these reports are true, and there was some question about some of the ones that came out just in the last day or two with regard to some $750,000 payments. But as far as the earlier payments are concerned, it's the kind of a thing that people may think, oh, well, this is embarrassing, particularly in light of current political environment. And then they decide not to mention it in some way. But once you go on the record and say, oh, I never did this, and even if you're not under oath or anything like that, just coming out and basically saying things that are untrue and proven to be untrue later, it can create an additional problem. Now, whether it crosses the line into something illegal or something of that nature, it certainly creates political problems, particularly for the Trump administration and Trump in particular, who is already being, is under fire for having maybe too close a relationship or too being too fond for Putin or Russia in general.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Join our conversation on this Politics Wednesday. Patrick in Fairfield. Hi, Patrick. What's on your mind as you listen?
Well, one question that's been running for a long time is, why are we demonizing the Russians? everything that's been said about their supposed hacking of the election, for example, has all been based on hearsay, anonymous sources, government intel agencies, a whole bunch of stuff that nobody's been able to substantiate. It's nice to actually hear the FBI say, okay, we are now doing a formal investigation. First time anybody's actually said officially, we have our concerns. No evidence.
Well, Patrick, just to back up there a minute ago, I think our intelligence agencies, a number of them, all of them are in a consensus that the Russians did meddle in our elections through the release of hacked emails via WikiLeaks and also through fake news. This is not disputed, I don't think.
Actually, excuse me, but are these the same intelligence agencies that also told us that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? Same guys?
Okay.
Different players, maybe, but okay.
Okay, let's get a reaction to your point, Patrick. Tim Hagel, what do you think about these assertions?
Well, there is. Patrick makes a good point to the extent that sometimes these folks are wrong, or they give us information that later proves to be incorrect. Not necessarily that they're lying or trying to hide anything, but they don't always get it right in one way or another. Another example that's come up in the last few days is the fact that a lot of these intelligence sources didn't know when the Soviet Union was actually going to collapse. That they were sort of expecting it was going to happen sometime, but when it happened, they were kind of caught by surprise. Well, okay, sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. I think that. In this case, though, that there's probably enough suggestion, I'll avoid using the word evidence, that the Russians were behind the hack of the DNC, release of the emails in various ways. Now, that's one thing, but is that really a hack of our election? To what extent is it really meddling? Does it affect any of the vote totals? And that was something Republicans talked about in the hearing as well. So, again, it's a question of how much they're involved, and that at least the public doesn't know yet. Maybe some of the intelligence agencies know more, but they're sometimes reluctant to say because then it reveals how they got that information, which then could hurt them in later intelligence gathering.
What about the charge of always demonizing the Russians? Scott Peters, do you have anything to say about that? I mean, they are on the world stage, they are doing things that I guess any state does, but they're not really a democracy, are they?
Well, they're not, and they are doing things that a lot of states do, but that most states would also be concerned if other states meddled in their internal processes and would want to figure out how that happened and how to avoid it. And when one just thinks about the clearly publicly available information that actually does not in any way depend on intelligence sources, it's fairly staggering. I mean, we know, for example, Russia has been quite open in the extent to which they've supported nationalistic parties in European advanced industrialized democracies. Across Europe, they've been supporting financially and through training and conferences in Russia. People affiliated with far-right parties. This isn't secret. This is quite out in the open. We know that independent intelligence analyses by tech firms, not by the intelligence community, but by folks who are concerned with protecting IT infrastructure and IT security, have looked at what's publicly available about the DNC hack and have concluded that that it had to be a state actor, and that by far the most likely state actor was Russia. I mean, there have been multiple reports about this. This is all based on publicly available information. When you add into that then the assessment of our own intelligence community, you get a pretty darn strong case that Russia was behind these hacks and was doing it for the purpose of trying to influence the election. And when you add into that the fact that a number of people in Donald Trump's orbit seem to have some connections to different Russian or pro-Russian groups, I think, to not investigate that would be pretty stunning. And just as a point of comparison, in 1996... people might remember that the Clinton campaign accepted, or the Democratic campaign, the Democratic National Committee accepted, I think somewhere in the order of maybe $2 million from people who had attachments to China, some of whom were Chinese citizens. This is in a campaign that probably raised, $400 or $500 million in those days. And you know, we rightly investigated that to try to figure out what was going on. So it seems appropriate to investigate this.
Okay, let's go to our before we move on, we're going to talk about the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. But first, let's get Tom in on this issue. Tom in Fort Dodge, welcome to our program.
Thanks. The outrage to me is that any office holder in Washington, D.C., in this case, that does not put the legitimacy of our elections.
Mm-hmm.
Has been given by our security apparatus, and it needs to be investigated, period. It has nothing to do with Trump. It has everything to do with keeping our government honest.
Right, right. And the credibility of our elections. You're breaking up there a little bit there, Tom, but I think we generally got the idea. Tim Hagel, this is bigger than Donald Trump in this one election.
Oh, it is. And again, it goes along with the integrity of the elections and so forth. And what we know so far is what the Russians have done again with the hack of the emails. But there are still questions in terms of there was any coordination, I guess, is the word that we're using for the most part between the Trump campaign and in particular what they're investigating, the Trump campaign and Russian officials. That goes beyond that in some particular way. And yeah, whether it's Trump or whether it would be Clinton or any other election candidate, if there's something along those lines going on, that we'd certainly want to know about it.
Okay, Tom in Fort Dodge, thanks for that. Quickly going to Robert. Not much time. Robert in Illinois, thanks for tuning in across the border. What's on your mind?
Well, I really was a fan of your caller, a couple of callers before. I object to the vagueness of this Russian hacking of election. Specifically, what individual or group in Russia hacked? Hacking means gaining unauthorized access to a computer system. DNC, well, what particular computer system in DNC? And what information did they obtain? Did they delete something or copy something?
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen or heard any negative I don't know what emails of Hillary's caused her to lose the election. I don't really hear any negative things about Hillary. So how did that? And that's a presupposition that all of this actually happened.
Okay, Robert, thanks. I don't know how much of our campaign coverage you were listening to, but we were getting a steady drip, drip, drip of anti-Hillary or inside Hillary's organization embarrassing emails. Scott Peters, you seem to know more about this too.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty widely reported during the campaign. I mean, the now president actually, you know, perhaps humorously, but nonetheless, you know, commented maybe the Russians could get more of her emails, you know, or could find the deleted emails or whatever. You know, I would encourage the caller to go Google independent IT security analysis of Russian hacking of DNC, and I think you'll turn up several stories by multiple independent technological firms that trace the specific user ID of the person who sent the emails to the DNC that resulted in the hack. And you can see the analysis there of why the scope of this attack almost had to be state-sponsored. And the targets of the attack suggest that it is almost certainly Russia.
Okay. In the last few minutes we have with you, Scott Peters and Tim Hagel, let's have your comments on where our health care repeal and replacement promise is by the Republicans. President Trump warning fellow Republicans of big losses at the ballot box if they fail to repeal and replace Obamacare, a full court press, so to speak, by the GOP leadership to get the votes needed by tomorrow. Tim Hagel, I've been looking at various accounts. As of this morning, I guess this is according to perhaps Politico, 21 House Republicans have flat out said they will vote against this bill to repeal or replace Obamacare. Five have indicated they're likely to oppose it. Now, the Republicans can only afford 21 defections in the House if no Democrats join them. So how are you reading this? What are you seeing?
it's a big question mark as far as what's going to happen, that there are some of those no votes. And again, it depends on how strongly they are a no vote. Apparently, there are some reports that suggest that maybe some of the people have said, well, I don't want to be the last one that, to create this, make this thing fail if it actually does. But they may have reasons for their own political future to not vote for this particular one based on the promise that it's not an outright repeal. Some have called it Obamacare 2 or Obamacare Lite. And for those reasons, they think it's going to be a problem, plus some of the data that came forth from the Congressional Budget Office basically saying, well, look, this is going to create additional problems, at least initially, in terms of a larger number of people that don't have insurance coverage. So there are a number of reasons why Republicans don't like it. And the question is, are they going to be able to get it at least through the House? But then, of course, you've got to get it through the Senate. And there are a number of senators where they have an even smaller margin have said, look, I don't like this either, because it doesn't, in fact, keep the promise of a flat-out repeal.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, perhaps you can comment on this, too. If you're a House member, a GOP member, you're being asked to put this to a vote when you see a lot of indications that it's dead on arrival in the Senate. So you're asking you're being asked for your yes vote on something that's dead on arrival.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a tight spot. And, you know, frankly, Paul Ryan, the Speaker, finds himself in the exact same position, just on a different issue, that his predecessor found himself in, John Boehner. And that's that every concession you make to the Freedom Caucus, the most conservative members who just want a straight up clean repeal of Obamacare, every concession you make to them, you lose the people in more marginal districts who are fearing potentially tight 2018 races. And every concession you make to the more moderate wing of your party, you lose the Freedom Caucus members. I think they are going to try to make the case that this is your chance, this is it, this is your one chance to repeal Obamacare, so you have to do it even if you don't like it. That seems to be the case that President Trump is trying to make.
What do you make of that prediction by President Trump? Does he have the politics right in his prediction, do you think, Scott?
I don't know. I mean, he made apparently in a closed meeting yesterday, it was leaked that he said, possibly in sort of in jest a little bit, but who knows, that he said, I'll come after you. I'll come campaign against you. My congressman here in the first district, Rod Blum, was quoted in the Washington Post this morning. This is a direct quote. He said, "I outperformed the president, so I'm not worried about that."
Mm-hmm.
He's not
afraid of defying the president.
That's right. Yep.
Okay. And he is one of the Freedom Caucus members who is.
He is. Yeah.
I don't know if he's a solid no vote. Do you know?
I think he is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Tim Hagel. So what are the implications of losing this vote? We may hear tomorrow that somehow the number of votes in the House are cobbled together by a slim margin, it passes. But how big a blow is this to the GOP leadership in Congress if this slips through their hands tomorrow? Do they have a second chance in the coming days?
It's hard to say. The conventional wisdom is no, they don't, that it is, sort of your one shot to do something along these lines. But it may depend on where it actually fails. If the House can get it through, but it's hung up in the Senate in some particular way, then maybe it's basically where can the blame be placed on this? But to a certain extent, I would agree that Trump is probably right. And it's partly because Democrats, of course, don't want any change to the law. So they're going to fight it. And they'll be perfectly happy to accuse Republicans of not keeping their promise to change the law if, in fact, this fails. And so that's why it's going to be a big issue, regardless of what happens in the 2018 elections.
Mm-hmm. This is one of the big issues, of course, being campaigned on for years, a big part of Donald Trump's campaign. He says Trump says that this has to happen before there's tax reform, a tax overhaul. Is he right, Tim Hagel?
Well, in a procedural sense, it made sense to do it this way because you need to see what's going to happen with the change in the health care law to know what you are going to be able to do with tax reform. But if the health care reform fails, then he's basically going to have to move on to what he can do then under the tax reform.
Okay. We have just a few seconds left. I don't know if there's any concluding remarks. Scott Peters, what you'll be looking at in the coming weeks. There's so many fronts to watch, aren't there?
Yeah, there sure are. I would say on the healthcare thing, I would say a good rule of thumb is that you can never underestimate the ability of the majority of party in the House of Representatives to get their agenda through. There still might be some way to do it. But even if they can get the votes, they've still got that problem that Tim identified earlier with, which is now how do you get it through the Senate? And mm-hmm. It's going to be much more difficult to get it through the Senate.
Again, I agree with Scott. Lots of things to look at, and it seems that it's an exciting time or an interesting time in sort of a bad way with so many things going on, hot topics and so forth. So we just have to stay tuned.
Okay. We certainly will do that. Tim Hagel, thank you, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Scott Peters, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Scott and Tim, thanks for coming into our respective studios. We appreciate it.
Welcome.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon with help from Chelsea Hoy. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Once again, a reminder, tomorrow we're going to talk about addictive technology. Can you imagine life without your smartphone? We'll talk about it tomorrow and see how addictive our new technology has become in our lives. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.